The headlines: Iran's president says his country's ultimate revenge for the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani would be the complete withdrawal of U.S. troops from the region. The U.S. State Department approves the sale of 3,000 bombs to Saudi Arabia despite international outcry over the kingdom's rights records and its deadly war on Yemen. And also, Germany's daily fatalities from the coronavirus pandemic top 1,000 days after it started vaccinating people. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour: Iran's president says his country's ultimate revenge for the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani will be the complete withdrawal of U.S. forces from the region. Hassan Rouhani said Iran has the right to take revenge for the killing of its top general. He said the U.S. killed Soleimani because he truly fought terrorism. Rouhani added the region owes its security and stability to the assassinated general. The Iranian president also said the U.S. and Israel are the only beneficiaries of insecurity in the region. Rouhani made the comments at a cabinet meeting ahead of the first anniversary of Soleimani's assassination. The top general was killed in a U.S. drone attack near Iraq's capital, Baghdad, on January the 3rd, 2020. Mustafa Khoshchashm is a journalist and commentator. He says Washington assassinated General Soleimani because he was the one who foiled U.S. plots in West Asia.
The reason why the United States killed General Soleimani is highly connected and interconnected to the timing of this assassination. Major or Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was the main reason why the United States plans, two large-scale plans in the Middle East failed. The U.S. Started the practice in order to impose a new order in the Middle East through the wars on Afghanistan and Iraq, and the major reason why it failed was General Soleimani, who mobilized many popular forces and defused the United States' plan to impose its desired order on the region. A second plan was using proxy forces, the militants that eventually led to the creation of Daesh or ISIS or ISIL in the region, through the United States proxy forces, allies actually.
Lebanese authors and artists have paid tribute to Iranian top commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani on the first anniversary of his assassination by the U.S. in Iraq. They unanimously maintained that the general managed to win the hearts and minds of the people in the region. Mayam Saleh reports from Beirut.
These days, Lebanon is hosting various events marking the first anniversary of the martyrdom of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. This book reads, "The Man Who Vanquished America," will be out in bookstores on the martyrdom anniversary on January 3rd. The author started writing after the martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani in January 2020, and the main inspiration for him was the personality of the man who changed the region and even the world.
This man is the man, in terms of strategy, is the man of the century. The United States could not beat him. On the contrary, he defeated the United States in many posts, in many positions, in many places, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Iran, and in Syria, in Lebanon, in Yemen, in Palestine. So he outsmarted them.
One of the main discernments of deep study of the assassination of General Soleimani was that the will of the resistance will be more adamant on removing the U.S. hegemonic presence from the region.
Achieved nothing. They killed the freedom in their mind when they killed Haj Qasem Soleimani. They killed justice in their mind and in their people when they killed Haj Qasem Soleimani. On the contrary, Haj Qasem Soleimani now is living in every person or a thinker who think that Haj Qasem Soleimani represents such slogans, freedom, justice, and liberty.
U.S. Army generals and strategists as well as those who grieved him, agree that the commander of the Quds force brought the people of West Asia together and made the cause of fighting U.S. oppression a united struggle. Other virtual events to commemorate the memory of the Iranian commander were held by a group of activists in the form of Lebanese traditional storytelling. Through this art form, the writers tried to narrate to the people of Lebanon the story of Commander Qasem Soleimani and his significant role in thwarting U.S. plots.
The biggest shock was when the U.S. Army General Petraeus read a message which read, "I am Qasem Soleimani, the commander of Al-Quds forces. I am the one who conducts the Iranian policies in Iraq, Afghanistan, Gaza, and the entire region. And the Iranian ambassador in Iran is a member of the Quds force."
Many in the region who knew General Qasem Soleimani or learned about him after his martyrdom say they have no doubt that his martyrdom and the deeds done during his lifetime will lead to a complete liberation of the region. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
1 year has passed since the U.S. assassination of top Iranian commander and resistance icon Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Our correspondents have spoken to a number of Syrian and Palestinian people about the assassination. Let's see what they have to say.
Qasem Soleimani sacrificed his life for the sake of Palestine and spent his life fighting for Palestine. His legacy will never die because thousands more Soleimanis will be born and a new night will lead the way.
His memory will remain forever in the hearts of Palestinians and Iranians. The assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was especially harsh for all of us in Gaza who remain under siege. The absence of Qasem Soleimani has encouraged Arabs to normalize their relations with our enemy. His martyrdom was a great loss for Palestinians who will find it harder to liberate their land. Since his martyrdom, Israel has stepped up its aggression and siege against the Palestinians.
Martyr Qasem Soleimani was a symbol of devotion and sacrifice for Syrian people. The services he did are unforgettable. He will remain in the memories of the coming generations in Syria. Words cannot describe his efforts and his sacrifices.
Qasem Soleimani.
May he rest in peace. He was a commander and a hero, a big hero, and a symbol of his steadfastness and sacrifice for us, especially here in Syria. I congratulate him on his martyrdom. Not all people are worthy of such martyrdom. The U.S. did not achieve anything from his assassination, because one Qasem Soleimani is gone, but 10 other Qasem Soleimanis will come. He stood alongside Syrians from Aleppo to Damascus. My brothers fought under his directives. They were ordinary fighters, but they told me he used to dine and spend time with them. He was so down to earth.
Soleimani was not the first and will not be the last resistance figure. The path of resistance and the way of Imam Hussein will live forever until liberating the last inch of every occupied land. Soleimani was a fighter, a struggler. May he rest in peace. He stood beside us. There are hundreds of others like Soleimani.
A year has passed since Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani was assassinated by the U.S. To Iranians, he was an anti-terror icon who played a key role in maintaining security in their country. But his popularity among Iranians goes beyond a charismatic commander who defeated the Daesh terror group. Soleimani is also highly appreciated for his selflessness and modesty. That explains why people refer to him as the Commander of Hearts.
Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, visiting a group of children in the northern province of Mazandaran months before his assassination. These children were amongst many more who had lost their fathers in Iran's anti-terror operations. The top general had a message for the children, that he is always there despite being busy as a military commander. And he did whatever he could to fill the void those children had, being so kind that the kids expressed their feelings whenever they wished, even if it was in the middle of praying. But now, all those moments are over. They came to an end after Soleimani lost his life in a U.S. drone attack near Iraq's capital, Baghdad. The bad news came to the Iranians in the early hours of January the 3rd, 2020. Many demanded revenge for the killing of a person they called the Commander of Hearts. They all remembered that Soleimani was a man of the people, a man who considered it an honor to serve those in need. That was quite clear in the spring of 2019 when many Iranian provinces were hit by devastating floods. General Soleimani and a number of friends went to the southern province of Khuzestan, one of the hardest hit areas by the unprecedented deluge. There, he joined others delivering relief and aid to flood-hit people.
خیلی مدیون هستیم به مردم اینجا و هر چی ما خدمت کنیم به مردم اینجا باز کنیم.
He extended his support to anyone needed within his reach. A humble person that behaved his countrymen with respect, regardless of his position as the head of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the key force responsible for Iran's anti-terror operations overseas. Millions turned out for Soleimani's funeral processions held in several Iranian cities, including his hometown, Kerman. The ceremonies were the last chance for people to pay respect to a person they were always proud of, not only for his brave actions on the front line, but more for his humane behavior.
Elsewhere, the United States has approved the sale of $290 million in bombs to Saudi Arabia despite criticism of Riyadh's human rights records. Earlier, we discussed the issue with our guests in our news review program. Here's what they have to say. Well, the United States has approved the sale of $290 million in bombs to Saudi Arabia despite criticism of Riyadh's human rights records. The U.S. will sell 3,000 small-diameter bomb munitions and related equipment to the kingdom. It has previously approved the sale of $478 million in air-to-ground smart bombs to the country. President Donald Trump's administration has also made arms deals with several other Arab states, including the UAE. The move comes despite congressional and public opposition to such military support. Critics have cited human rights records in cases of Saudi Arabia and the UAE. They've cited huge civilian deaths caused by their war in Yemen. American lawmakers now have 30 days to block the sale. Otherwise, President-elect Joe Biden will decide the fate of the deals. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have political analyst and Middle East expert Saeed Shahabi joining us from London. Also, we have international lawyer Barry Grossman joining us from Bali. Let's start off with Mr. Shahabi in London. Mr. Shahabi, how do you view this recent deal?
Thank you very much. It is one of those strange decisions by the United States, which is well aware of the intention of the Saudis, their practices in recent years, and how much suffering has been inflicted on the Yemeni people. They are well aware, the politicians in the White House under President Trump are well aware that these bombs are going to be used in Yemen by the Saudis to kill Yemenis. And according to the international bodies, including the Red Cross and others, many of the victims have been civilians, children, and that Yemen is facing one of the most catastrophic natural famine because of, well, famine because of the imposed sanctions and blockade on Yemen. So they are effectively participating in the killing of civilians. And we hope that the new president, President-elect Biden, will block them, will stop such immoral provision of arms and logistical support to aggressive armies of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates.
Mr. Grossman, let's cross over to you now. With these weapon sales, not just from the United States, but also Britain, which has been involved in the transactions and arming the Saudi-led coalition in the war against Yemen, the question is not only are these Western countries complacent with the crimes that are taking place in Yemen, but they're also complicit as well.
Well, absolutely. I've been saying that from the very beginning. I don't think on any reasonable analysis, it's possible to reach a view other than that the war imposed on Yemen by the usual powers, that is the United States, the United Kingdom, to some extent France, all supported by, of course, the United Nations, is anything other than an unlawful, belligerent war against the sovereign nation. And when we look at these continued arms sales, all I can really say is the hypocrisy of the United States and its allies has never been more clear. Their contempt for international law regarding armed conflicts has never been more clear. Remember, it's the United States that unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA and sought and essentially imposed a very elaborate system of sanctions on Iran, ostensibly the United States claimed, because of human rights violations in Iran, because of Iran's activities in the region, which, of course, the United States deems to be a regional threat to the national security of other nations, and because of so-called threat as potentially a nuclear power. But when we look at the reality of things, it's Saudi Arabia that's been waging war on people in Yemen. It's Saudi Arabia that, to some extent or another, backed the war in Syria. It's Saudi Arabia that props up the regime in Bahrain, which continues to wreak havoc on the Shia majority there. And of course, it wasn't that many months ago that Congress itself in the United States imposed an arms sale embargo on Bahrain, which was subsequently lifted with the blessings of President Obama. So we come to this current situation. It's a real shocker. All of the reasons cited for imposing sanctions on Iran are flatly ignored when it comes to Saudi Arabia, bearing in mind, of course, that the United States has also given or sold nuclear technology to Saudi Arabia in violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and has turned a blind eye, if not actively run interference to support Mohammed bin Salman in matters where he's been caught out, his regime has been caught out literally butchering people and kidnapping Saudi nationals abroad who are an inconvenience to them. So it's a real tragedy.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. We're going to leave it there. That was Mr. Saeed Chaabi joining us from the British capital, London. Also, thanks to international lawyer Barry Grossman joining us from Bali. And with that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. Welcome back. Germany's daily coronavirus death tolls crossed 1,000 for the first time since the pandemic broke out. Over 1,100 people have died of the virus in Germany in the past 24 hours. The country's total death toll now tops 33,000 out of more than 1.4 million cases. Germany is one of the hardest hit European countries by the pandemic. The continent began its COVID vaccination program on Saturday. That comes as concerns are high over the new COVID variant that has surfaced in Britain. The strain has now spread to many countries and outside Europe. That has prompted governments to impose travel bans on the UK to contain the new version that spreads faster. On Wednesday, Norway extended the ban. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa by a shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyr Soleimani is a champion of the Iranian nation and of the Islamic Ummah. This is the part of a speech delivered on December 16, 2020, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the officials of Shahid Soleimani commemoration anniversary and with the family members of that great martyr.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent and Merciful, all the praise is due to Allah, the Lord of the Worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master, Muhammad, and upon his pure household, and may God curse all their enemies. First of all, I very much thank the brothers and sisters who organized the Shahid Soleimani commemoration anniversary and who also organized commemoration ceremonies for other great martyrs of the world of Islam, including the martyrs of defending the holy shrines. We could also refer to the event that the honorable family of our esteemed martyr organized under the name of the Soleimani School of Thought. All these are very good, necessary, and beneficial events, and by Allah's favor, they should be pursued in a powerful, vigilant, and careful way. All of you should do your best. As our Sardar, Sardar Hussein Salami, the Commander-in-Chief of Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps mentioned, you should pay attention that the events related to our dear Shahid Soleimani be public events.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
In other words, it is the people themselves who should cooperate and show their creativeness in various cultural areas, as they did so during the burial ceremony and other such events. We should not confine the events to particular groups and orientations. What I wish to say about the martyrdom of our dear Shahid Soleimani, I will never forget his memory, and that of Shahid Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, may Allah bestow paradise upon them, is that the Soleimani's martyrdom is a historic event. It is not a normal event that will be erased from historic memory. The event was recorded in the history as a brilliant incident.
The United Arab Emirates has become a trade hub in the region with strong links across West and South Asia and Europe. The country has, among other things, been trying to establish itself as a large and fast-growing marketplace for gold. According to data collected by the Observatory for Economic Complexity, the UAE's gold imports have increased by an average of 58% to over $27 billion in 2018. The Arab country's fondness for gold comes amid its plummeting oil reserves and the UAE's drive to diversify its economy. Gold has proven to be a lucrative commodity in the past months, particularly as investors favored the precious metal as a safe haven during the uncertainties in other markets as the coronavirus pandemic hit. The importance of gold for Dubai's economy is such that its trade volume surpassed that of diamonds, oil, jewelry, and cell phones in 2019.
The United Arab Emirates has no gold on its own, as is clear. They have oil, but they have no gold yet. Gold is their second largest export. So all of their 17.7 billion of their gold export is being imported first and washed or laundered by re-exporting it mainly through the UK into Switzerland and other gold refining places like India.
But there's another side to this story. The United Kingdom's Home Office and Treasury issued a report on money laundering and terrorist financing, labeling the UAE as vulnerable to illicit activities due to a lax policing of gold movements across the country. But how does the UAE acquire all that gold? And where does the country buy the exorbitant amount of precious metal from? According to investigations conducted by The Sentry, an NGO that tracks dirty money linked to African war criminals, 95% of gold officially exported from Central and East Africa, much of it mined in Sudan, South Sudan, the Central African Republic, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, ends up in the Emirates. Gold has funded armed conflicts in the region for years, but the jump in prices in the past few months has turned the metal into new blood diamonds, as it's been increasingly obtained through brutal mining practices and illicit profits, including the use of underage workers.
First, the international gold laundering is a gigantic human rights abuse, foremost because it uses many countries in Africa, in South America, are using massive child labor. Children not only are put in tremendous risks, working in the mines in narrow, rickety underground tunnels that could collapse anytime and often do, but they are also poisoned on a daily basis by chemicals used in extracting gold from the rock.
In 2016, the UAE declared gold imports from 25 African countries worth $7.4 billion, which had not declared any exports to the UAE. The Emirates declared $3.9 billion more in gold from most of the 21 other countries it imported from Islam was declared in exports.
Gold laundering is an international crime because it is mostly run by mafia-type organizations, where killing and other type of violence, plus sexual abuse of women, forced prostitution, are a daily occurrence. It's actually the law of the day, you could almost say, in these illegal gold mining areas. There should be an international law enforceable, issued by the UN, if at all possible, and enforced, must be enforced, by the International Criminal Court against anything to do with gold laundering.
Gold's small size and high price make it a suitable target for smuggling, and the UAE's minimal control and regulations have turned the country into a magnet for the metal. The situation has become so dire that the London Bullion Markets Association called on Dubai and other gold hubs to conform to the regulatory standards or face a blacklisting of their exports. While the UAE has promised more transparency, only time will tell how and to what extent the country will fulfill its pledge.
The U.S. is facing another crisis thanks to the actions of the U.S. President Donald Trump. This time, it has to deal with the massive COVID-19 relief bill. Donald Trump said that he is unhappy with the massive bill, which provides $892 billion in coronavirus relief, including extending special unemployment benefits. $1.4 trillion is also needed for normal government spending. The U.S. president said that he is not signing it, in part because that one-off $600 stimulus checks for struggling Americans are not large enough.
I am asking Congress to amend this bill and increase the ridiculously low $600 to $2,000, or $4,000 for a couple.
An increase to the size of the checks was something Democrats attempted to get, but Republicans refused to accept it, throwing it further into doubt the future of any imminent financial relief for millions of struggling Americans. However, the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi plans to hold a vote to approve the $2,000 checks on Monday. Another objection made by Trump was that the bill gives too much money to special interests, cultural projects, and foreign aid.
$600 for the past several months that Americans haven't received any assistance is almost nothing. It's $1.75 a day. It's quite pathetic, especially when you look at how the rest of the bill gives millions of dollars. It gives $33 million to Juan Guaido. It gives millions of dollars to Israel to regime change measures. And this $600 essentially is going to go to landlords. It's going to go to banks. Americans are going to see that money, and it will be gone in the next moment.
Trump's refusal to sign the bill is not just affecting jobless benefits. The partial government shutdown will begin on Tuesday, unless Congress can agree a stopgap government funding bill before then. The U.S. president's move surprised many, particularly since Trump left nearly all of the negotiations to Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, who made no push for the $2,000 stimulus checks that the U.S. president is now seeking. All through the months-long wrangling between Democrats and Republicans over the stimulus package, Trump did not say anything. He didn't object to the terms of the deal before Congress voted it through on Monday. But since then, Trump has constantly complained about it. If he continues to refuse to sign the bill, more than 14 million laid-off Americans could lose their unemployment benefits for weeks. Even if Trump finally agrees to sign it, they would likely suffer a break in payments. States cannot pay out benefits for weeks that begin before the bill is signed. Now, as a result of Trump's refusal to sign the bill, benefits will not restart until the first week of January, but they will still end in mid-March, effectively trimming the extension to 10 weeks from 11. Moreover, a series of additional relief provisions, including an eviction moratorium, are set to expire at the end of the month. Other temporary relief protections shielding millions of Americans from the brunt of the pandemic's economic toll will lapse shortly after the new year without action. Top officials, including Pelosi and Mnuchin, are now privately discussing plans such as a stopgap spending bill in case Trump formally vetoes the measures by Monday.
but it is not clear how long that stopgap measure would last or whether Trump would sign it if it makes none of the changes that he wanted. Trump never said that he would veto the legislation anyway. However, he may not have to. The legislation passed with the support of, well, more than two-thirds of both the House and the Senate, easily surpassing the threshold required to override a veto if he actually did that.
It appears to be a partisan divide. Now Trump is saying he won't sign the stimulus package because it's too low. But we also have to look at the fact that when this bill was signed, it was signed with a supermajority in both houses, in both the House of Representatives and in the Senate. And we gotta also remember that the Democrats now have the majority in the House of Representatives. So because they had two-thirds in both the House of Representatives and the Senate, it really doesn't matter if Trump refuses to sign it or not. Of course, the Congress would hope that Trump signs it and that they can get it done, but they could still veto his veto.
But in this scenario, timing means everything. The legislation can become law 10 days after the bill is enrolled, even without a presidential signature. But because the time frame overlaps with the end of the current Congress in January the 3rd, and the convening of the 117th Congress, some called a pocket veto can become a possibility. A pocket veto is a legislative maneuver that allows the U.S. president or another official with veto power to exercise that power over a bill by taking no action instead of affirmatively vetoing it. If that happens, all legislation dies with Congress. So without Trump's signature in the next 10 days, the bill would have to be reintroduced and voted on a second time. This means more delay in funding of the government and providing relief to struggling Americans and businesses.
Yemen is currently the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. Yemeni people are facing a long list of unbearable problems such as daily airstrikes, famine-like conditions, different deadly diseases, and an economy in tatters. Meanwhile, Yemeni children are undoubtedly the most vulnerable part of the population. The situation of children in Yemen has been described as a crisis within a broader humanitarian catastrophe. This week, Yemen's health minister once again raised the alarm about the situation of children in his country. Taha al-Mutawakkil said 3,800 children have been killed in attacks carried out by the Saudis and their allies over the past years. He also warned that the aggressors' bombardment campaign has devastated Yemen's health infrastructure, making it increasingly difficult to save children. The plight of the Yemeni kids has once again come under the spotlight just a few months before the sixth anniversary of the beginning of the Saudi-led military offensive against Yemen. Earlier this month, the United Nations Children's Fund said one Yemeni child dies every 10 minutes from a preventable disease, 2 million are out of school, and thousands have been killed or maimed since 2015. The United Nations has been quite loud in voicing concern about the ongoing crisis, but it is also under fire for removing the Saudi-led coalition this year from a blacklist of child killers. The Saudi-led alliance was first blacklisted several years ago for killing and injuring children in a war.
The United Nations, of course, has this very typical, very endemic weakness, I dare say, being that it's an organization that for a big part is dependent on the world superpowers to really take action. And we have seen in the past that for this reason, it is very difficult sometimes for the United Nations to really come into action, even when a lot of the member states might want to. We have enormous pressure from Saudi Arabia.
It was on March 25, 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its allies, such as the United Arab Emirates, began pounding Yemen from air, sea, and ground. Now, another anniversary of the beginning of the offensive is drawing close with no end in sight to the campaign. Why is this war dragging on so long, and why is the international community failing to put an end to it? The invaders launched a bloody offensive in the hope of achieving a quick victory. However, to this day, none of the stated goals of the military campaign have been met, with the Saudi-led onslaught being described as a fiasco. But the invaders are not changing course. They have indiscriminately bombarded civilian areas. markets, funerals, wedding, jails, medical and water supply facilities have all been hit. This has taken a heavy toll on Yemen's infrastructure and civilian population. Western countries, particularly the United States and Britain, have refused to review their ties with Saudi Arabia over the bloodshed in Yemen. They have instead intensified their backing of Al Saud. The United States and Britain have stepped up their arms sales to the regime despite the human suffering in Yemen. Meanwhile, the United States has provided the Saudi and Emirati forces with different types of military assistance. Critics insist the heavy U.S. military support has made America a partner to the devastating war. Observers believe without Western diplomatic and military support, the UNSTAR would have ended a very long time ago.
The sworn enemy of the Iran nuclear deal will be leaving office very soon. The U.S. President Donald Trump, who unilaterally withdrew America from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action in May 2018, left no stones unturned to completely destroy the JCPOA. Trump managed to significantly undermine the hard-earned international deal, but he failed to achieve his ultimate goal of killing the deal. Now, just weeks before Trump becomes a former U.S. president, the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal renewed their commitment this week to preserve it. The foreign ministers of Iran, China, Russia, Germany, France, and the United Kingdom agreed on Monday that no party should set fresh preconditions on a revival of the JCPOA. Their statement is believed to be paving the way for Washington and Tehran to come back into full compliance when Joe Biden takes office in January. Trump tried to destroy the deal by imposing tough sanctions and scaring off other countries from doing business with Iran. In response, Tehran has rolled back some of its JCPOA commitments. The next U.S. president will need to remove Trump's favorite sanctions against Iran, and Tehran, in return, will be expected to put back in place certain limitations on its nuclear program based on the JCPOA.
But if they return to the nuclear deal and into full compliance in action, Tehran will do the same by returning practically into full compliance. What is important here is that that return by the U.S. or some other parties to the nuclear deal into compliance, if it happens, theoretically that will not suffice. What they need to do is that they return practically and in action.
The U.S. president-elect has pledged to restore the JCPOA when he takes office. Will America take this opportunity to rejoin international diplomacy and multilateralism? The Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has repeatedly said that American sanctions deprived Iran of the benefits that his country is entitled to under the nuclear deal. Iran's top diplomat says the Europeans share the blame of the irreparable economic harm to Iranians. On Monday, Zarif took to Twitter after the meeting with his counterparts from China, Russia, Germany, France, and the UK. He posted a chart showing how trade between Iran and the EU has gone down over the past years, despite repeated European promises of better economic ties under the JCPOA. Zarif warned that this is the last chance for the Europeans to save the deal. The top diplomat said that Tehran will quickly reverse the measures that it took in response to the U.S. withdrawal and European breaches if they perform their duties well. Iranians are undoubtedly infuriated by the West's failure or unwillingness to properly implement the deal. Recently, Iran's parliament passed a piece of legislation that would prevent UN inspections of Iranian nuclear sites if sanctions are not eased within 2 weeks after Biden takes office. The new law would also require the administration to enrich uranium to the 20% level using advanced centrifuges. Some senior European diplomats, like the UK Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab, said that Iran should not further dilute its nuclear commitments. Some observers believe, however, that instead of lecturing Iran, the EU should immediately focus on how it can properly fulfill its own commitments.
I think the one side that can have demands is Iran, because after the withdrawal of the United States from the nuclear deal, that was Tehran who remained in the deal. Iran showed strategic patience for a year, and after that 1 year, Iran's reduction of commitments happened under the terms of the nuclear deal. So they have done the violation, and the Europeans were, despite their words and promises, were unable to compensate the U.S. withdrawal and exit from the nuclear deal.
Time is fast running out. Iran's top diplomat insists that no democratic country should expect the government to violate the deadlines set by the recently approved parliamentary legislation.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billahi al-aliyy al-azim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wa sallallahu ala sayyidina wa nabiyyina Abil Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad. Wa ala alihi al-tayyibin al-tahirin. La siyama baqiyatillahi fil aradin. Ajjalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-sharif. Wa ja'alana min a'wani wa ansarih. Last night we talked about a very important dimension of balance that must exist in every person and in our community. And that is the balance that we should strike between being emotional and being rational. We need to have both, and if we lose one of them or if we overdo one of them, then it creates problems. I mentioned two hadith about the significance of having a kind of emotional unity or connection or link with Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And now I'm going to share with you the third hadith, which leads us to another characteristic of the community, and that is truthfulness. Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi as-salam, in a famous hadith, said, إِنَّ اللَّهَ تَبَارَكَ وَتَعَالَىٰ أَطْلَعَ إِلَى الْأَرْضِ فَاخْتَارَنَا وَاخْتَارَ لَنَا شِيعَةً. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala looked at the earth, looked at the people, and among them He chose us. And He chose for us some Shia, some followers. يَنْصُرُونَنَا. These are the people that help us. These are the people that work for achieving our goals. Then Amirul Mu'mineen said, "Man adha'a sirrana, adha'ahu Allahu ba'sa al-hadid." If someone discloses our secrets, Allah will make him taste the pain of iron. It means that he is going to see the attacks of the enemies, the swords and bombs and killings
coming from enemies, prison, torture, because he was not careful about keeping the secrets. So we have to be very clever, very intelligent to understand what to say, to whom to say, when to say, how to say. You cannot say everything to everyone at every moment. This is not working. Unfortunately, we see only, most of the time, when I say 100%, only one type of words and speech and statement and presentation coming, no matter it is a Shia or is a non-Shia, is a Muslim, non-Muslim. Everything that we say to everyone in the same way. We don't have that much of sophistication to have different products nicely prepared, packed, presented to different types of people. Some people have some problems. They cannot take this product. We should give them another product. But we say, no. We do one type of, you know, commemoration for Imam Hussein. Whether you like it or not, this is your problem. But then sometimes people come and see, and they don't like, because they are not prepared for this. Sometimes I have heard people who were thinking of becoming a Shia. They were in the process of research. But when they attended some of the majalis of Azadari, they said, this is not my way of, you know, life. This is not going to work for me. This is good for you. Because we have made it so much cultural that a person new to the school of Ahlul Bayt would not understand. Even people inside the community sometimes don't understand and don't appreciate. So we have to be very careful.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here, who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
A few years ago, I made this suggestion, and I repeat here, maybe inshallah some people listen, alhamdulillah, after that suggestion something good came. So maybe inshallah again something good can come. My humble request is that our community in any part of the world, we should dedicate one night of Muharram or before Muharram to educating non-Shia and non-Muslim about Imam Hussein. Because if you look at our normal majalis, it's good for us. Alhamdulillah, we are thankful to Allah. But it's not planned in the way that you can invite someone or bring your colleague or your neighbor to the majalis and say, okay, come and learn. Because for many reasons. One is that because in every night we address a little of bit of the tragedy. Also, we do many other things that they don't understand. If before Muharram comes, we invite our neighbors and say, you know, we are soon going to commemorate the event of Karbala. So we would be very honored if you could join us in this weekend to our center, for example. We want to have a little presentation about what happened in that point in history and why we are commemorating. So when they receive this letter, the letter by itself is helpful. Even if 10% come each year, gradually after 10 years, you have educated the whole neighborhood. A little film, video clips, a very nice 20 minutes presentation, some refreshment, question and answer if they like. In this way, we can educate people about Imam Hussein. But if we just, you know, show what we are doing for ourselves to them, maybe they don't understand. And maybe even they don't appreciate because they don't have the background, they don't have the clue. So my suggestion is to plan, inshallah, in the way that at least one night, one day, at least 10% of our energy and resource goes to educating other people also about Imam Hussein. If we don't introduce Imam Hussein, who is going to introduce Imam Hussein? Do you expect other people to come and introduce Imam Hussein to the English people? We have to do this. I think we haven't done enough. And I feel very sad and embarrassed that even today when we want to introduce Imam Hussein, we say that this is, you know, what Gandhi said about Imam Hussein. This is what, you know, for example, Nelson Mandela said about Imam Hussein. I'm not saying this is bad. Yes, at this stage, maybe we don't have any other choice. But this is really embarrassing. It must be quite opposite. All the leaders of the world, all the people who are well-known celebrities, they must have known Imam Hussein and they must refer to Imam Hussein. Not that today I need to prove Imam Hussein by referring to these people. Isn't this a shame for us that people know more about Mother Teresa than they know about Lady Zainab? It's a shame. Not because I'm against Mother Teresa. I respect Mother Teresa. But I say it's a shame for us that people know about her more than they know about Lady Zainab. If they had known about the values of Lady Zainab, how then even some Muslims could think of attacking the shrine of Lady Zainab? Isn't this because we were not also doing good enough to introduce the lady? The hatred is there, the ignorance is there, but I say we have to also blame ourselves. We cannot put all the responsibility on the others. We have not also done enough to show the beauties, the values, the qualities that the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam had. So Amirul Mu'mineen said, "Man adha'a sirrana adha'ahu Allahu ba's al-hadid."
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe is hard. And my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
Oh Allah, please send your salutations to Muhammad and all Muhammad. Oh Allah, please forgive us. Please forgive all our sins and mistakes and shortcomings. Please enable us to serve you with full honesty and truthfulness and sincerity. Please include us among the best followers of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad. Please protect and safeguard our community and our families and our youths from everything that you don't like. Oh Allah, please hasten the reappearance of Imam Zaman Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. Please make our Imam Zaman happy with what we do and what we say. Please answer his du'as for his faraj. Please give shifa to all people who are ill. Please give shifa to people who are ill in their body and in their soul. Oh Allah, please send your rahmah, your forgiveness to all who have passed away, especially brothers and sisters who were attending these majalis in this community and other communities. Our parents, our foreparents, our teachers, our ulama, our maraje, those who have passed away, please let them be with Muhammad and Ali Muhammad right now. And please give long life and blessed life to the parents and to the teachers and maraje who are alive. Oh Allah, please make the last moment of our life the best moment of our life. Wa akhiru da'wana and alhamdulillah rabbil alameen.
My ummah, he will say. Rasulullah on that day, even though we've strayed from him and his way.